Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Trampoline Hall Podcast. I am Misha Globerman, and I'm going to tell you right now, this podcast contains mature language. Trampoline Hall is a lecture series that takes place in a bar, usually in Toronto, sometimes in other cities. People give lectures on all kinds of subjects. There is one rule, which you probably know if you listen to the podcast regularly, which is that the lecturers cannot be professionally expert on the subject on which they are speaking. That is what sets us apart in the highly competitive barroom podcast lecture space. After each lecture, we take questions from the audience. You may wonder who the lecturer is this episode. Well, stop wondering, because I'm about to tell you. The topic of the lecture is the perfect baguette, and the lecturer is Mark Ben-David.
Thank you. I always feel like you should adjust the mic even if you don't really need to, just because that's what's done or something. Yeah, I know. What is the perfect baguette? Maybe the question in itself insinuates too much judgment right off the bat. Maybe it suggests that the Frenchest of all things must naturally be concerned with perfection, and maybe that just shuts half of us right down anyways. After all, isn't the baguette the emblem of the working class and the only bread in France whose price is declared and protected by federal law? Maybe then my question is wrong. What is a true baguette? What characteristics does a baguette have that bring it closest in form, texture, weight, and taste to what a baguette should be? And more importantly, why is the ideal of a true baguette important to uphold anyway? To defend the baguette is to defend our right to live properly. I don't mean richly or more like the French. It just so happens that in the past 150 years, they have built a just society upheld by a pillar of patience and compassion, and that pillar is the baguette. I began baking when I was about 8 or 9. My mother generally indulged me. I had a ferocious sweet tooth, but there was something more about the nature of baking which mystified me. After I assembled its components, it began to have a life of its own. I started with simple stuff. I experimented with pound cakes. I made the ice cream cones for my 10th birthday. We often visited family in New York, and for Independence Day one year, my cousin PJ and I made giant Rice Krispies square decorated with clumpy homemade icing as the American flag. Now, lest you think I was born with some freakish talent to get every formula perfectly right, remember that every good baker fails a hell of a lot more than he succeeds at first. Once, for example, taking over from my mother on a Saturday morning crepe breakfast, I used whole wheat flour on a whim, and we had 6 chickens at the time, and none of them would even touch them, because we certainly wouldn't. The chickens will eat poo, for those of you who don't know, but they wouldn't eat the pancakes. Anyways, for the following Christmas, I asked Santa for a chef's hat. I was 10 years old. Now, speaking of chickens, my most persistent fantasy in my childhood came from a picture book we were read in school. La petite poule rousse was a hen who one fine day comes across some grains of wheat. Touched by some unknowable force, she overcomes her impulse to eat them and decides instead to plant the wheat to make bread. She solicits help from her various farmhouse friends to sow, harvest, and mill her wheat, and then to knead her dough and stoke the fire. But they all have more pressing commitments, and she is forced to execute every step of the process herself. Needless to say, when the loaves come out of the oven, everybody wants some. That story seduced me. I wanted to plant wheat, build a windmill, scratch the leftover clumps of mealy flour from the millstone's wedges. I wanted to turn those wingfuls of wheat into a baguette. Why? Baking felt good. It, like planting a garden, it attained an alignment of work and reward that I could, to a certain degree, control. And the reward for the work didn't depend on the approval of others, or if it did, those others were unseen forces or God or luck. But it was ultimately an independent act. I could decide what I wanted to make, follow the recipe, and produce something. To take up the bag of flour is to accept a timeless challenge. Our curiosity, our creativity, and our hunger, the triple inheritance from our ancestors, wills us to take up that challenge. And as we do so, invisible forces, physics, chemistry, biology, history, spirits, ghosts, they all hold court above our hands or our wingtip thingies and decide among themselves whether we pass or fail. When Marcel Proust wrote The Remembrance of Things Past, it made the Madeleine, a small and unimposing French pastry, famous. In the book, the narrator is weary and dull after a day of doing nothing, with only the prospect of a depressing morrow. At first, he doesn't even feel like tea or biscuits. But the moment the Madeleine touches his tongue, he is flooded with potently beautiful memories from his childhood. He says, "No sooner had the warm liquid and the crumbs with it touched my palate than a shudder ran through my body and I stopped, intent upon the extraordinary changes that were taking place. An exquisite pleasure had invaded my senses. I felt something start within me, something that has been embedded like an anchor at a great depth. I do not know what it is, but I can feel it mounting slowly. I can measure the resistance, and I can hear the echo of great spaces traversed." What the narrator is talking about is the profound happiness he felt as a child when he visited his aunt in the countryside. The taste reminds him suddenly of the park full of flowers and the cobbled streets and the spring air, and finally, his smiling aunt herself in her bedroom on Sunday mornings, greeting him with a soft morsel of her own madeleine dipped for him in her own cup of tea. Now, the baguette has something of the prosaic beauty of a mathematical formula to it. In 1993, the French government passed a law, Law 931074, stating that traditional baguette could contain only four ingredients: flour, water, salt, and yeast. And from this anemic list, the baker must create something delicious, moist, chewy in the mouth, and almost hard enough to break a filling. What happens is this. Among the thousands of molecules found in wheat, three most important ones are gliadin, glutenin, and starch. When the gliadin and the glutenin come in contact with each other and with water, they begin to assemble in long elastic chains called gluten. The more they sit around and the more they are moved, the longer and stronger these chains become. Gluten is like the steel infrastructure in a building. The starches on their own are flavorless. They're complex carbohydrates that are too massive for our palates to derive flavor from. Enter the yeast, an organism which feeds on those massive molecules and breaks them down into myriad smaller ones which we can taste, and as they do so, they fart out little carbon dioxide farts which leaven the dough. The thing is, you can make all these things happen rather quickly if you want to. If you wanted to make a baguette and you started right now, in three hours flat, you'd have just that. But it would only resemble a baguette. You could keep the dough extra warm to speed up the rise and throw in a little sugar to jumpstart the leavening. But the baguette could serve as a prop and not much more. When yeast works fast, it tires out. It produces lots of gas very fast and then chokes itself on it. Literally. It's the 100-meter sprint. The secret, which stands stubbornly in the face of good economics and business, is that good bread takes time. By slowing down the process, you keep the dough cool, and as it rises, you punch out the CO2 and you put the yeast on a slow jog, which in the end produces countless different sugars, running the flavor gamut from nuts and caramel to malt and wood. And then in a professional oven, it bakes the baguettes at about 650 degrees, and it has a steam injection mechanism, which for the first few minutes of baking, hardens the crust. As the heat forces the steam into the outside few millimeters of the dough, the starch molecules gelatinize into a sort of wet skin, which after the oven dries up and continues to get hotter, becomes a hard shell. And if you're willing to throw cups of boiling water into a hot oven several times as you bake, you can imitate these ovens at home. So, a true baguette will surprise you by the lightness of its weight and the pungent sweetness of its smell. The tops, quickly slashed with blades just prior to baking, allow the inner crumb to expand and bloom out. They should have hardened. These cuts are called the grigne. This translates as a fold of the lips to show the teeth. Yes, your baguette should be grinning at you, and that grin should be hard. Hard enough that if you accidentally were to strike someone behind you in line at the bakery, it should draw blood. And if you should find yourself biking, as French people are prone to do, it should last a few miles under your arm without changing shape. So a few summers ago, I needed a job, and I went to one of the priciest French restaurants in the city. The restaurant and its adjacent bakery were run by an Alsatian man. We'll call him M for the purpose of this lecture. His wife, a militant Bosnian woman, let's call her B, had platinum hair and a face mostly obscured by massive sunglasses. She would pull up in a black SUV around 4 o'clock in an actual cloud of smoke and her hair in curlers and 6,000 keys on her keychain. She was like, imagine Donatella Versace, but beautiful and dressed as a stormtrooper. She terrified me. I loved M. He fulfilled the stereotype requirements of the French chef audaciously. He was fat and mercurial. The kitchen was his empire, and like an emperor, he didn't do much. His minions chopped and filleted and sauced and fried, while on occasion he poked steaks to check their readiness. He cursed incessantly. Once he referred to his previous wife as a cunt to their 12-year-old son. He chain-smoked in the kitchen just beyond view of the patrons who dropped on average $150 for their meals. But a creative force burned inside this man. His sourdough cultures lived in great white buckets in the coat room. He claimed they were made from a bacterial culture started by his baker grandfather in France 100 years ago. He'd smuggled them into Canada, and now they bubbled and farted underneath the checked mink coats. He said, any fucking asshole can make bread from baker's yeast. That's easy. Sourdough is different. At the time, his bread, while insanely overpriced, was better than anyone's. It had substance. It was chewy. When you bit some off, the part that remained in your hand bounced back slowly to its original shape. The crust was rock hard, and while his success depended on Torontonians accepting that there was something magical about his bread, which made 25 cents of ingredients worth $5.75, the bread was actually simple. It took a day and a half to prepare. It fermented slowly. It rested overnight. There weren't any unpronounceable ingredients in it. He treated the grain with compassion and patience, and in return, it bought him a mansion in Rosedale and shopping trips for B to New York every month. A few years ago, Nigella Lawson was in town signing copies of her latest book. It was late October, and it was raining and cold, and I thought, she's far from her children, she's far from home, how can I comfort this woman? So I baked for her. I invented components as I went along, and then I wondered as I waited in line whether I would be accosted by her handlers or snubbed at by one of her many assistants. And when I finally stepped up to her podium, because they had put her like this queen up on this podium, I just blurted out, I hope it's not against book signing protocol to offer you something I baked. And she looked at me troubled and concerned, like a mother would look at a child who's expressed some sort of self-doubt unnecessarily. And then finally she said, no, of course not. How kind. It smells fantastic. Nigella understood. Of course she did. Amid all the kerfuffle around us, we were two strangers meeting on a deserted country road, shaking hands, discussing the weather or the almanac or whatever. Everything else, the photographers, the crowd, the knot in my stomach, her copious bosom, everything vanished. The baker doesn't bake to impress or show off. It is a private act born of an impulse which, after 4,000 years, we cannot suppress, or I cannot suppress. I bake because it makes deep sense to do so. I bake to give away the bread more than to eat it, and it is that urge to feed others which makes us all bakers, standing alone before a bag of flour, contemplating the possibilities. The smell of bread baking, like the taste of the Madeleine, awakens some primordial memory in us, which brings us running to the oven. I think we all belong in front of.
Mark Ben David, ladies and gentlemen.
You're listening to the Trampoline Hall Podcast. I'm Misha Goldman. Up next, the Q&A.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!"
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Are there any questions? Why you, sir?
Is it too personal to ask what Nigella's response to your cooking was?
How did Nigella like your bacon?
Okay, well, this is the part that isn't as sort of nice. She was wonderful, and I opened it up, and she said it smelled fantastic, and then she sort of passed it to one of her assistants and said that she was going to eat it all later that night. So whether she like sent it to the FBI or something, I'm not sure. But she liked the smell.
That's the first step.
Do the accents again. It was rubbish.
Oh. A real British person. Oh. Maybe she's from a different part of England. There's lots of parts in England.
He thought the accent was rubbish. Yeah.
Do you enjoy cooking as much as you enjoy baking?
Do you enjoy cooking as much as baking?
Yeah, but it's not the same sort of spiritual experience. Cooking is fun and fine, and I probably do it a lot more than I bake, but it doesn't feel the same way.
How come?
Because it's all you doing it. Right. It's all me doing it, and it's me and it's food and whatever, but when you bake something, it's sort of like this agreement with what you're creating that if you behave as you're supposed to, it will behave, and you never really know if it's going to until it's all over.
Right, and it all happens without you. Like, it's kind of you set it in motion, and then it's like, okay.
It's like a baby.
Yeah, exactly. If you're a very bad parent, it's like a baby. You just set it going, and then you come back, and when it's done, you see if it's okay. Oh, yes, you, sir, yes.
So here's the back end, the end game, or is it...
Well, that's the wonderful thing about the baguette. If you don't have Nutella or cheese or butter or anything, it can be the end game in itself if it's good enough.
For you, do you like to have a baguette just on its own, or do you like to have it with other things? Is that
no,
the question?
Baguette is like a desert island food if there was only one thing. Like, it would go for that, but I eat so much bread that it's never really just like I always want to smother it with something else. Yeah, cheese, butter, Nutella.
And that's not like a controversial choice in the baguette circles. Like, people aren't...
There aren't
people who are like, you should just have a meal of baguette. Like, that's not a...
I don't think so.
Okay, good. I'll go to you, sir. Yes, as I drop more papers.
Okay. I went to a restaurant, got a Tunisian sub, where they scoop out the middle of the baguette.
Those are horrible people.
Yeah. I was just going to get a thought of what people are gutting.
So people hear that over there? That Okay, you heard it. Okay, good.
That's the Tunisian baker people. No, and you're wondering what my thoughts about that are?
Is it okay to hollow out the center of a baguette
to
fill it
up
with stuff?
Yeah, it's okay. You can do whatever you want to the baguette. I have been known to do that myself. Sometimes, again, I keep mentioning Nutella, but sometimes you do just want to have, like, crust and chocolate without the crumb inside. So, yeah, feel comfortable in doing that.
And are you just saying that, or do you really think it's okay?
No, I do think it's okay.
All right, and then what do they do with the bread? Do they just, like, throw it out, or? Can I have that? You ask for the extra bread. And what do they say? It was your sandwich? Was it, or were they making a sandwich for someone else? And they're like, hey, you guys are just throwing that out. I'll make like a backwards Tunisian sub where I wrap the meat around the inside of the baguette.
The problem is I had to make some Tunisian sub, but when they gave me the insides, it was kind of mushy.
It was mushy from the digging. So it's not so good.
Because like a real baguette, like it's so chewy and tough inside that you can't just scoop it all right out. So, but maybe they were using counterfeit baguettes.
All right, yes, you, sir, yes.
I've heard that when Marie Antoinette said, let them eat cake, it was actually bread, is that?
It was brioche. She said, let them eat brioche, which was a sort of colloquial French way of saying cake, yeah.
So it was cake, literally. Yeah.
All right, so I'm glad we cleared that up.
Well, a brioche is sort of halfway between bread and a cake, where it's fermented and kneaded like a regular dough, but it's enriched with eggs and butter and sugar, so...
Was she actually being practical or not?
Yeah, was she actually saying,
I mean, did she, we don't, I mean, who knows if she even said that? It serves our purposes as post Marie Antoinette-ist to say that she was a wicked old bitch that would say something like, let them eat cake. But, you know.
Does anyone know? Is it true that no one knows whether she said it? Because some of those things, people know that stuff. So no one knows that? No one knows whether she really said that? What's the point of having so many people in one room if no one's going to know a simple fact about Marie Antoinette? Okay, all right. Sorry, I'll move on from my disappointment and try to... Yes, you.
Where's the best place to get a true baguette, and where's the best place to get a perfect baguette?
Where's the best place to get... Wow, that's a best place to get a true baguette and a perfect baguette. And do you mean in the world, or do you mean... In the whole world, why?
Okay,
in
well,
the world.
A true... First, I'll say that I think a true and a perfect baguette are the same thing. In the end, and you can get one in a good bread baker's kitchen. There's a place on Roncesvalles that sells them. It's called Mabel's Bakery, and they sell baguettes. The French chef, whose name I can't mention, sells a really perfect baguette.
Why can't you mention his?
Oh, because all those things are mean, and I shouldn't.
Okay, because you don't want him to know. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's to it.
Yeah, it's Mark. It's Mark. It's Mark Thewitt.
All right. Okay, so the best place, the perfect.
But it's not necessarily France. Like I've had the worst baguette. Actually, I've had the worst food across the thing in France. So you can't just go to Paris and expect to have the best baguette because they'll sell you shit baguette, no problem. What you want to do is find a place that takes a day and a half to make their baguettes instead of a few hours. Yeah, but Brick Street makes good baguette as well.
So there you go. Fancy restaurant? Yes, it does. Yes, you, the lady who knows the baker.
If something like a perfectly grilled piece of fish defines a really good cook, is it the baguette that really defines a great baker, or is it something else?
So the question is whether the baguette is the best test of the great baker,
if greatness is measured by like the ability to wrestle complexity, then I would say no, because once you know how to make a good baguette, you can just sort of do it with your eyes closed. I'd say something that's more... that would sort of describe an amazing baker would be something like a really perfectly crispy on the outside, soft on the inside, unrolling oily croissant. Like that's
hard. That's a better test.
Yeah.
It's the baguette, not a good, a delicious bread, but not a good test. Yeah. Okay, good. So that's good to know. Yes, you, sir. Yes.
Is there a history of serious wounding from the baguette?
A lot of people get hurt from the baguette.
I don't know. Although there was a theory that the original reason that they shaped it in a long thing like that was so that the Napoleonic soldiers could stick it in their boots as they were walking away to war. So maybe I can imagine someone in a desperate moment, like having lost his bayonet, just like... But there's no proof.
Stick it in their boots, you mean just like as a way to store it?
As a way to store it and carry it around. Because it's given to people as like their daily bread, you know? Like prisoners in France, for example, they get like a baguette and like ration it across the day. It's one of the things that they get, so.
If you had like a bunch of dinner rolls, that would be unwieldy.
Yeah.
But you have a long...
Yeah.
All right. Okay. That makes sense. Yes, you, sir. Yes.
If the tradition goes back more than 150 years, the baguette reflects these memories of things gone past, why do we need a steam injection oven?
Yes. Yeah, so, yeah, what's the relation between the steam injection oven and tradition? Because presumably that's not something that they had originally. They didn't have this like special steam injection oven.
Yeah, well, my idea, well, my thought is more that the Madeleine reflects something that sort of harkens back to an earlier period where someone took the time to prepare a Madeleine for this child. And the baguette right now, because we're used to, and we were all born in the era of steam injection ovens, we're used to like good crunchy baguettes. That for us is something that represents a true and solid baguette.
So, but the baguette now, the perfect baguette now, is it actually different than it was 150 years ago?
Absolutely.
And is it better? Is it like a technological improvement, do you think? Because of
I don't
steam
know. I don't know. I mean, you'd have a hard time getting the hardness of a crust from a good baguette that long ago. But then again, they probably developed steam injection ovens because bakers were making a habit of like pouring hot water into the ovens to sort of mimic that.
So maybe they got a similar process, but just not as automated. I was sort of hoping to imagine that the baguette was on this sort of steady upward slope of progress, and that like in the year 2100 there would be like an even better baguette that would be so delicious we'd look back on today's baguette with disgust, you know, or whatever.
Yeah, there might be.
It's like the thing you least think is going to be affected by technology is like, oh well, baguettes are getting more delicious. Like you wouldn't expect that.
Well, that's the wonderful thing about them. What I mean is that, I mean, you could advance, for example, I would agree that they've advanced now that they have steam injection ovens and now that they're better. But as far as making the process simpler and faster, I don't know if you could, because what takes time is, unless you found some sort of yeast, which like...
But that would be the next step. Like the next step would be
genetically
some sort of,
modified
modifying yeast for like maximum deliciousness.
Maximum deliciousness at low temperature, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yes.
So there we go. So therein lies. If your question was, what is the future of the baguette, which I think it's fair to say it was, then the answer is that it lies in genetically modified yeast, that creates more deliciousness faster.
Yes.
All right, yes, you, sir, yes.
So my friends in France would fight for the end of the baguette, the really crunchy part. Do you have a favorite part?
What's your favorite part of the baguette?
Yeah.
It's a wonderful question.
I like those crispy ear top thingies, the green. I like those. Like if you get a good one, you can just sort of like tear it off sideways, and then you have like hard as rock leading into sort of soft interior in one bite.
That is a very good part. Yes, you, ma'am, yes. Have you ever heard someone with a baguette?
I can't remember.
Physically, I assume.
I can't remember if I have.
Have you ever heard someone emotionally with a baguette?
I don't think so either.
Really? Wow, the baguette...
I mean, apart from this audience tonight, but I don't think so.
You, ma'am, yes. What's your favorite thing to bake?
Oh, mother. No, I was asking my mother. Not
oh, your mother,
mother.
Is there.
No, my mother.
Because I was going to say, I don't know if you know, but you just said mother.
No, as in most performances. As is the case with most performances, my mother finds the most conspicuous spot to sit in the second row under a light. So I was actually referring and asking her. Favorite thing to bake? Okay, probably croissants. Those are fun, yeah.
And is that true? Do you think his favorite thing to bake is the croissant?
It's the challenge. Sorry.
Because he likes the challenge. And are his croissants, are they good? They are. They're pretty good. Do you bake as well? Not as well as he does. Okay. All right. So we have agreement. We have agreement. It is the croissant. There we go. As confirmed by his mother. Why would she lie? Anything else? Yes, you, sir. Yes.
Ace Bakery makes a whole wheat multi-grain baguette.
Ace Bakery multi-grain baguette. Would you eat that baguette?
I don't want to sound like a snob, but I wouldn't eat a whole grain, multi-grain baguette, even not being a chicken. Just because if you want a whole grain bread, then go for the whole grain bread. But like, a baguette is not, for me, a whole grain experience. You want it to just be like extremely chewy and crispy, and you can't get that amount of chewiness and crispiness when you have that much fiber in the dough. It's just not possible.
All right, I think that's advice we can take home with us. We'll wrap it up there. Ladies and gentlemen, Mark Ben-David, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Trampoline Hall was created in Toronto in the 21st century by Sheila Hetty and is hosted by me. This episode's lecture was chosen by Shalom Krishtalka. The podcast is produced by Josh Block. Our theme music was composed by Matt Smith. Trampoline Hall is a Sumo Audio podcast. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook. If you enjoyed the podcast, it really helps us out if you want to leave a rating or review on iTunes. So please go ahead and do that.
I'm Misha Globerman. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.